I looked around the room. Was there anything here I wanted? I didn't think so. And in the rest of the house? I did another quick tour. I could see that my father had rescued a couple of good pieces from Langley Hall, the satinwood bureau in his study with the inlaid marquetry and tiny drawers with their carved bone handles. I'd always admired that. And the grandfather clock that was supposedly over 300 years old. Certainly not the sagging sofa or well-worn leather armchair he always sat in to watch television. Upstairs, there was an elegant bow-fronted chest of drawers in the main bedroom, and a gentleman's armoire with drawers down one side, and racks for hanging shirts and trousers on the other. It was a fine mahogany piece, but again I was struck by the contrast of the elegant furniture and the pitifully few garments hanging in it. Apart from that, a couple of paintings on the walls, a hunting scene, and a framed print of Langley Hall in the 18th century, with elegant Jane Austen figures strolling in the grounds. If I'd been born in another century, I might have been making a good match with Mr. Bingley, I thought, and had to smile. I supposed that some of these might fetch some money at auction. I certainly had nowhere to put any furniture, and I didn't particularly like the paintings. I'd have to find out when they would become legally mine. I knew a little bit about probate through my own work. If the person left no property or shares or other tangible assets, then probate was not necessary. But I'd need to obtain a death certificate, and would have to wait until the coroner released the body. I wondered if he had a solicitor who could direct me. Presumably some law firm had been in charge of the sale of Langley Hall and the payment of death duties. I should go through his desk, or, failing that, see if he had a safe deposit box at the bank, which they wouldn't let me open until I had the death certificate. It all seemed overwhelming and complicated, and I don't think I had ever felt more alone. To realize that one has nobody in the world, that is a sobering thought. I knew that my mother had been an orphan, my father the only son of an only son. I might have had distant cousins somewhere, but I had certainly never met them. No good comes from moping around, I told myself. Since I was not yet at liberty to start packing up his things, I'd go into the village and see the vicar about a funeral. Maybe he could telephone the coroner and find out when the body would be released. Having something positive to do, I gave myself a wash and brush up and walked into the village. As happens so often in April, the sunny day had now clouded over with the promise of rain any moment. A cold wind had sprung up from the west, and I realized my folly of going out without an umbrella. I'd be soaked by the time I reached the village. The mile walk seemed to go on forever. I pressed myself against the hedgerow, until suddenly I heard the hum of an approaching motor, and almost considered holding out my thumb for a lift. As it happened, I didn't have to. It was a delivery van, and it came to a halt beside me. The driver leaned over and opened the passenger door.
"It's never Joe, is it?" he called. "Do you want a lift?"
I took in the big man with his florid face, trying to picture who he might be. When I hesitated, he added,
"It's me, Billy. Billy Overton."
I saw then the writing on the side of the van. Overton's Bakery, fine bread and pastries. I gave him a grateful smile and climbed up beside him. "Billy Overton," I said. "I didn't recognize you." He grinned.
"Well, I have to admit I've put on a few pounds recently. I was a skinny little kid when we sat next to each other in school, wasn't I?"
"You were, and so shy that you hardly said a word." He burst out laughing at this.
"You're right. I've come out of my shell these days. Had to, really, since I deal with the public all the time."
"You're working for your dad now, then?" I asked as he let out the clutch and we drove on.
"That's right. Went straight into the business after school. We've opened a couple more shops now. One in Whitley, one in Hambledon. Doing really nicely since they put in that big housing estate. Now Dad concentrates on the baking, and I make sure the retail side is going smoothly."
"Good for you," I said.
"How about you?" he asked. "What are you doing with yourself?"
"I'm a lawyer," I said. "At least, I will be when I take the bar exam later this year."
"A lawyer? Fancy that."
He nodded with approval.
Well, we always thought you'd make something of yourself. You always were the smartest in the class.
You were pretty smart yourself, I said. I seem to remember we had a contest going for who was top in the maths test each week.
I did always have an aptitude with sums, I have to admit,
he agreed.
It stands me in good stead now, since I handle all the books. Dad cooks the bread and I cook the books, as my wife says.
And he gave another big, hearty laugh. You're married, then?
Married? I've got a 3-year-old and another on the way any day now. How about you? You married too?
No, I haven't found the right man yet, I said.
Well, I suppose not. You've been busy with your career.
Did you marry a local girl? I asked, turning the subject back to him.
Pauline Hodgkiss, he said. You remember her?
But we always hated her, I blurted out before I realized this wasn't tactful. She was so snooty, going on about her dad's nursery and the nice car they had.
She's improved with age,
he said, turning to give me a cheeky grin.
And it's useful having the nursery and market garden in the family. We get fresh strawberries for our tarts.
He paused, then his face grew solemn.
I suppose you're down here on account of your dad, then? It's true that he's dead, then? We heard the rumour that he'd died, and my mum saw the ambulance going past.
That's right, I said. He was found by the headmistress out in the school grounds. She thinks it must have been a heart attack.
That's terrible, he said. I'm so sorry for you. Nothing's worse than losing your parents. I remember when you lost your mum and how hard that was on you.
I nodded, scared that if I opened my mouth to speak, I'd cry.
My parents always felt so sorry for your dad, he went on. They said it wasn't right that he had to sell his home like that, not when it had been in the family for generations, and provided employment for generations of us people in the neighbourhood.
I suppose it's happening all over, I said. Nobody can afford to run these big houses anymore. They're like white elephants, aren't they? In constant need of repair and costing too much to heat, and nobody wants to be a servant any longer. I paused, thinking. At least I suppose I should be glad that I didn't inherit Langley Hall, or I'd have been faced with the death duties and the painful task of selling up.
So you won't have ties here any longer,
he said as we turned into the village high street.
No reason to come down this way again.
This struck me like a punch in the stomach. No ties to the place where I grew up, where my family had lived for so long. Nowhere I belonged ever again. I looked away out of the window so that he didn't see the despair in my face.
So where can I drop you?
He asked. The vicarage, please. I'll have to arrange for a funeral.
If you want cakes or sandwiches for it, just let me know and I'll supply them. On the house.
And he smiled. Thank you. You're very kind. I heard my voice wobble as I said the words. He came around to help me out of the van.
Are you staying at the lodge or going back to London?
No, I'd better stay here while I sort things out.
Then let me know if you need a lift back out to Langley. I should be around for an hour or so.
Thanks, Billy. You always were a good friend. He actually blushed, making me smile. As I walked away, a car drew up on the other side of the street. A window rolled down and a voice called,
Miss Langley!
I turned to see Dr. Freeman. I went over to him.
I'm so sorry about your father, he said. He was a good man.
Were you the one who was called to him yesterday morning?
I was. Poor chap. He must have been dead for a while when they found him. Massive heart attack, I'm afraid. Nothing that could have been done, even if someone had been with him.
This made me feel a little better. At least he hadn't lain there alone and calling for help. Will they be doing an autopsy, do you know?
No need, he said. I've submitted my report that the cause of death was a myocardial infarction, a heart attack. There were no signs of foul play. No reason to submit him to the final indignity.
Thank you, Doctor. So his body can be released for burial?
It can.
He got out of his car.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm already 2 hours late for lunch and my wife will not be pleased.
He gave me a friendly nod and walked toward his front door. I continued on to St. Mary's Church. The church itself was a fine old grey stone building dating from the 14th century. The vicarage was less old and less attractive, solid red brick from Victorian times. I was about to walk up the path to the vicarage, when on impulse I turned the other way, pushed open the heavy oak door, and went into the church instead. I was immediately enveloped in the cool stillness of the place. It still had that wonderful smell that old churches have, part damp, part old hymn books, and the lingering scent of burned-out candles. I stood there, staring down the nave to the altar window with its original stained glass of the Virgin Mary holding the baby Jesus. I'd always loved that window as a child. The Virgin's robe was the most beautiful blue, and when the sun shone through the glass, it sent stripes of blue and white and gold onto the choir stalls in a way that had always seemed magical to me. I watched it now, trying to recapture that feeling of peace that always came to me in that church. But the Virgin looked out past me, that chubby baby so secure in her arms, her serene smile mocking me. "Look what I've got," she seemed to be saying. "Isn't he perfect?" I closed my eyes and turned away. I started to walk around, staring at the walls, studying the monuments and plaques to generations of dead Langleys. As a child, I'd known them all by heart. Edward Langley, Baronet Josiah Langley, Eleanor Langley, aged 22. And now it was as if I felt their presence. "Don't worry," they were saying. "You'll get through this. You're a Langley. We're strong." "It was all right for you," I thought. "You had a home to go back to." A noise behind me made me jump.
"I thought I spotted someone going into the church," the vicar said. "Joanna, my dear, I'm glad to see you seeking comfort from the Lord."
Actually, I'd been seeking comfort from my ancestors, but I let him pray with me before he led me back to the vicarage, where his wife served me tea and a big slice of fruitcake.
Chapter 6. Hugo. December 1944. They came out of the trees to find the ground rising steeply before them through the mist. First a grassy knoll and then a rocky crag, topped with what looked like an old ruined building. A flight of ancient worn stone steps had been cut through the grass. Then a steeper flight ascended the rock to the remains of some buildings. At least that clearly used to be the case, but part of the rock had been destroyed, and the steps now clung precariously to the side of a sheer drop. At the foot of the flight was a post with the words, "Pericolo, ingresso vietato," danger, entrance forbidden. "It doesn't look as if the monks have been here for a long time," Hugo said.
2 years now."
Hugo had been thinking it was an old ruin. 2 years?
"It was bombed by the Allies."
He reacted in horror.
"We bombed a monastery?"
She nodded.
"It was necessary. The Germans had taken it over and were using it as a lookout point. They brought big guns up here to shoot at passing aeroplanes, and to command the road in the valley."
"I see. So the monks had already left?"
"Yes. They were turned out when the Germans arrived. It was a famous chapel, with beautiful pictures. The Germans looted all the artwork. May they burn in hell. The buildings are now beyond repair, and we are forbidden to go here."
"Then leave me now. I don't want to get you into trouble."
"Who will see?"
She spread her hands. He'd always noticed how expressive Italians were with their hands.
"The only reason anyone would come here at this time of the year is to look for mushrooms, like me, or to set a snare for rabbits."
She patted his arm.
"Don't worry. I will be careful. When the place is swarming with Germans, one learns to move like a shadow. Come. Shall we try to climb these stairs?"
"Oh, if you don't mind, I'll go up on all fours like a baby," he said. "Steadier that way."
"Then give me the stick and your bag."
"Oh, it's my parachute," he said.
"Parachute? Good silk?"
Her eyes lit up.
"When you no longer need it, I can use it to make new underclothes. We have had no new clothes for years."
He was amused. "All right. It's a deal."
"You start to go ahead of me," she said. "I will make sure you don't fall."
As if she could catch me, skinny little thing, he thought. He dropped to his knees and started to haul himself up the stairs. He had to put weight on his wounded leg at every step, pain shooting through him. At one stage he thought he was going to vomit, so he paused, breathing hard. He made it to the top of the first flight. It had begun to rain in earnest now, fat drops pattering onto his leather bomber jacket. Ahead of him, the damaged steps rose, impossibly steep, cracked and dangerous. He dragged himself up one by one, conscious of the drop beside him. The steps were wet and slippery, and he had a vision of himself sliding off with nothing to grab onto. A metal railing ran up one side, but he was too low down to use it. At last, he made it to the top and lay panting on the wet rock. She came to stand beside him.
Well done, Signor. Come, only a few more steps, and we will find you a place that is dry and safe.
She helped him to his feet and draped his arm over her shoulders again. The incongruity of it crossed his mind. The upright Englishman who kept his distance from women and addressed them with polite frostiness, now draped over a strange Italian woman he had just met. They went across the slick pavement of the forecourt, now broken and uneven, one small step at a time. She held on to him firmly, supporting him. Now he could see that the lower buildings to his left were reduced to complete rubble. It was hard to tell what they had been. In fact, they were beginning to look like part of the rock itself. Plants had grown up between the fallen stones. A small tree now sprouted between cracked flagstones, and a vine of some sort, now dead, sprawled over a pile of rubble. But the building immediately ahead of them, to which she was taking him, still had walls standing, although the roof was gone. There were three broad curved steps, leading to what had been a church door, although the door itself now hung at a crazy angle, swinging in the wind. She pushed it aside and stepped into the area beyond.
Well, it's not very welcoming, but it's better than nothing.
She turned back to him.
At least you will be out of the wind here, and we can build you a shelter with some of this fallen wood.
He had dragged himself the last few feet into the former chapel. Amid the utter destruction were still signs that it had once been a house of worship. The walls had been painted with frescoes, now pockmarked and washed away by rain and wind. A headless saint stood in one corner. Small glimpses of the black-and-white marble floor showed through the piles of dust and rubble. He saw that the wood she had referred to consisted of the great beams of the fallen ceiling. She's decidedly optimistic, Hugo thought. He didn't think they could move such beams between them, even if he'd been fit and mobile. But he did notice the pews that lay strewn around, and the broken cupboard in one corner. Presumably in time he could build up the fallen blocks of stone, if he was planning to stay here for long. He couldn't see that happening, however. There would be the matter of food, for one thing. But he also couldn't picture himself making his way across country in his current state. Almost as if she was reading his thoughts, she aided him to a big stone and eased him down onto it. Then she pulled some prickly shells from her pocket.
Here, the chestnuts. Eat them. They are better than nothing. I will try to return with better food for you.
No, you must not come back. It's too dangerous. I do not want to put your family in danger. You have been very kind, and I thank you.
It is nothing.
She gave him a sweet, sad smile.
My husband has been missing for 3 years. I hope and pray that if he needed help as you do, someone would do their best for him.
May I know your name? He asked.
It is Sophia. Sophia Bartoli. And yours?
I am Hugo. Hugo Langley.
Hugo, this is an Italian name. You have Italian ancestors?
Not that I know of. He winced in pain as he moved.
Let me see your leg,
she said, noticing his grimace.
Let us see how bad it is.
Oh, no, please, don't worry yourself. I can take care of it.
No, don't be silly, I insist. Where is the wound? Can you roll up your trousers?
It's just above my knee. Really, I can take care of it when you are gone. I think there is a first aid kit in my parachute pouch. He hoped she caught the gist of what he wanted to say. He'd spoken haltingly as he fished for unfamiliar words. What he actually said was, "Items for aiding make clean in my sack for parachute."
Allora. Let me see. We must remove the trousers, I think.
He was reluctant to take down his trousers in front of a strange woman, but she was already lifting up his leather jacket and unbuckling his belt. Signora, no. He tried to push her hands away. She laughed.
Typical Englishman. He would rather bleed to death than let a woman see him in his underwear.
Have you met any other Englishmen? He asked, amused at the outburst.
No, but one hears that they are cold, like fish. Not passionate, like our men.
Oh, not all cold like fish, I assure you, he said. But we are brought up to behave correctly at all times. She looked up at him and smiled.
At this moment, I do not imagine that you will have any improper ideas if I see you with no trousers on. Come on, let us get on with it. I must return home soon, or they will start to worry that something has happened to me.
She helped him ease down his trousers, and then saw the long johns beneath them. At the place above the knee, they were stuck to his skin with dried blood.
Jesu Maria, she exclaimed.
She dropped to her knees beside him and tried to pry away the fabric as gently as she could. He gasped at the sudden pain.
I'm sorry, but it must be done, she said. Do you have a knife? We must cut it away, I fear.
He retrieved the knife from his boot and helped cut the underwear free above the wound.
Water,
she said.
I need water to ease the fabric away and then wash your wound so that we can see how bad it is.
And before he could answer, she had darted out of the sanctuary, leaving him alone. He hobbled to an overturned pew, righted it with much effort, and sat on it with his leg outstretched before him. In the half-darkness, it was hard to see just how bad his leg was. He rummaged in the parachute pouch and located the tiny first-aid kit in the central pocket. It contained wound dressings, a roll of bandage, a tourniquet, iodine, and, to his great excitement, a vial of morphine in a syringe. He had just opened a wound dressing when Sophia returned.
"I have found water,"
she said, sounding triumphant.
"The rain barrel was overflowing, and I collected some in this tin mug I found."
When she saw his suspicious face, she added,
"Don't worry. I washed it out as best I could and wiped it clean with my petticoat."
She saw what he had laid out on the bench.
"Oh, you have good things there. Now, if you permit, I will try to clean your wound for you."
She started to cleanse the area, gradually peeling away the stuck fabric until it came off. The blood saturated the dressing long before the area was clear.
"Your wound still bleeds, I fear. We must apply pressure to stop it."
But what if the bullet is still in there? Shouldn't we try to locate it first? She gave a wonderfully expressive shrug.
A bullet will not matter if you bleed to death first.
She took the bandage, unrolled it, made a wad, and pressed it onto his wound. He cried out in pain.
"Of course, I forgot. The bone may be broken. Here, hold this without pushing too hard."
He did as he was told, but said, "I have morphine here. It will help to deaden the pain." She watched as he injected it, nodding with approval.
"When I return, I will bring bandages and a piece of wood for a splint."
She looked at him.
"Be careful as you pull up your trousers again. That wool fabric would not be good if it sticks to the wound. Perhaps you should not pull them up. Maybe your parachute can help keep you warm. I will try to bring a blanket, too."
He grabbed at her hand. "Signora Bartoli, no. I do not want you to take anything your family might need, and I do not want you to take risks for me. I would certainly appreciate some food and a splint, but then I will try to be on my way. Even if I meet some Germans, I'm a pilot. I will be a prisoner of war and treated fairly." She looked at him, then shook her head and laughed.
"You think those animals would treat you fairly? In a village near here, they lined up the people and shot them for helping the partisans. All of the people, babies and children and old women, bang, 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 all dead. And the Germans are now afraid. They know they are losing. Their line is no longer holding. Every day, they are pushed back a little further to the north. You would be a liability to them. No, I do not think they would treat you fairly. We just have to pray that the Allies get here soon."
She put her hand on his shoulder.
"Have courage. I will return when I can. You should not try to light a fire. The smoke may be seen."
She paused in the doorway to look back at him.
"May God watch over you."
And then she was gone.
Chapter 7 Joanna April 1973 The funeral was held on a rainy Tuesday. The weather had looked promising over the weekend, but on Monday afternoon it clouded over again, and by nightfall the rain had begun. At the time of the funeral it was a bleak and blustery day. I hadn't expected anybody to come, but was surprised by the number of local people who filled the pews and later stood around the grave with me while the rain dripped from our umbrellas and onto the coffin. It seemed a fitting send-off for my father that the heavens were weeping for him. Afterward, the vicar's wife and Billy Overton's bakery had prepared a fine spread in the church hall. One person after another came up to me to express condolences. Some of them I knew, others were complete strangers, but they all had some association to Langley Hall and my family.
"And my mother was in service at the hall when she was a girl, and she always said how kind the old squire was to her when she got scarlet fever."
Similar stories over and over, until I realized that everyone present resented the loss of the hall as much as my father had done. It represented the passing of an old way of life, of the security of knowing one's place. I found it very touching. As the crowd thinned, a young man came up to me. I had noticed him at the gravesite. He had been wearing a Burberry raincoat, his face hidden under a big black umbrella. Now he was wearing a well-cut black suit.
"Miss Langley?"
He had red hair and freckles on his nose and looked absurdly young.
"I'm Nigel Barton. You know, Barton and Holcroft, your family solicitors."
"Oh, Mr. Barton." I shook the hand he held out. "How do you do? I'm pleased to meet you. I was wondering whom I should contact about the formal side of things and whether my father left any sort of will."
"We do not possess a will, Miss Langley. Have you been through his papers?"
I did glance through his desk, but then I felt uncomfortable about going through things when I wasn't sure I had a right to.
"You are his daughter."
He smiled at me.
"I think that gives you every right. Perhaps you would care to come to the office in Godalming tomorrow and we can see how I might be of help to you."
He handed me his card. "You look awfully young to be a partner in a law firm," I said, before realizing that this wasn't very tactful. He laughed.
"Not a partner yet, I regret to say. The Barton in the firm's name was my great-grandfather. We've been your family lawyers for a couple of hundred years. I've only been qualified for a couple of years, and I'm very much the junior of juniors."
"I am supposed to take my own bar exam this year," I said.
"Of course. I heard that you were reading law. We'll have lots to talk about. Maybe I can take you to lunch tomorrow. The Boar's Head down the street from our offices serves a pretty good meal."
I hesitated. A man inviting me out to lunch. I wasn't sure I was ready for that. "I'm sure that's not necessary, nor is it part of the usual service," I said, and saw his face fall.
"It's not, but it's a really good excuse for me to have a slap-up meal instead of the usual sandwich," he said.
He gave me a hopeful smile. "Why not?" A voice was whispering in my head. "He looks harmless enough. It's not as if he's inviting you to a nightclub. Not a date. Strictly business." I managed my own smile. "Thank you, Mr. Barton. It's very kind of you." He beamed as if I'd given him a present.
"I won't keep you now, then. I'm sure all these people are waiting to talk to you. Around 11:30 tomorrow, shall we say?"
Billy Overton and Dr. Freeman both offered to drive me home, but Miss Honeywell appeared out of nowhere and I rode home with her.
"It was a very satisfactory funeral,"
she said as we left the village street and turned into the leafy lane.
"You must feel comforted by how many people came and by the reverence in which they hold the Langleys."
"Touched and surprised," I said. "I only wish my father had been alive to hear all the nice things they said."
"I'm sorry I was a little late," she said. "A last-minute phone call with parents who were in the Middle East. I had to reassure them their daughter would be kept safe from gardeners and grooms."
I chuckled. "And did you reassure her?"
"I'm not sure. These foreign girls grow up so sheltered that they hurl themselves at any man."
There was an uncomfortable silence.
"You'll be going back to London, I take it?"
"Not for a few days," I said. "You asked me to clear out the lodge, and I haven't yet found a will, so I don't feel comfortable disposing of my father's belongings.
I don't think he left very much, did he? She said. I know he kept a few good pieces of furniture from the hall, but apart from that... Oh, and I believe there are still a couple of trunks of personal items that he asked if he could store in the attic. You should take a look at them when you have time. Mainly things like old trophies and photograph albums, I think. And some family portraits. You may want to keep some of them.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to look through them.
Come over whenever you like. The front door is open during the day.
I'm afraid I have no idea how one gets to the attic, I said. She laughed.
Of course. I always think that you once lived at Langley Hall.
I was born in the lodge, I said.
Don't worry. I'll have one of the gardeners bring your father's things over next time I see them.
We had reached the gates to the school. She stopped the car to drop me off at the lodge.
Your employer doesn't mind your taking this time off?
She asked. They have been most understanding, I said, not wanting to touch on the truth. I thanked her and let myself in. Again I was struck by the feeling of cold and damp, almost as if the lodge itself was echoing my father's sadness and despair. I told myself that I should make an inventory of everything, but felt suddenly drained after the funeral. I realized I hadn't eaten any of those cucumber sandwiches or sausage rolls or little cakes, and wished now that I had packed some up to eat later. I made myself a cup of tea and a slice of toast. Then I decided to call Scarlett. Scarlett was my former college roommate. I was currently occupying the sofa in her flat, having had to move out of my last digs in a hurry. She was completely different from me. For one thing, she was a Cockney whose father ran a pub. Her name wasn't really Scarlett, either. It was Beryl, which she hated. She felt that Scarlett suited her personality much better. She had embraced everything that the 70s stood for. She wore long, tie-dyed skirts. Her unruly hair half covered her face. She smoked pot, and she went on protest marches against war and for women's rights. I had always been the good one, the studious one, focused on my degree, not on ending the war in Vietnam. But surprisingly, we got on really well. She was kind and easygoing, and she had welcomed me instantly when I'd had nowhere to go. She now worked in the theatre, assistant stage manager at the Royal Court, known for its avant-garde plays. I wasn't sure I'd find her at home mid-afternoon, but the phone picked up after several rings.
"Yeah, what do you want?" said the grumpy voice. It sounded more like, "What do you want?"
"Sorry," I said. "Did I wake you?"
"Oh, Joe, it's you, love. Don't worry about it. I had to wake up anyway in 10 minutes. Dress rehearsal tonight. New play. 10 women on a train going to Siberia. Bloody depressing, if you ask me. They all end up committing suicide. And talking of depressing, how was the funeral?"
"Very nice, as funerals go."
"And how are you coping?"
"Keeping my head above water describes it best. The lodge is about the most bloody gloomy place you could find. But I've got to go through my father's things and get it cleared out for the next tenant, so I won't be back for a while."
"No problem. I'm not planning to rent out your bed. Not planning to invite anybody into my own, either. I've had enough of men."
"That new actor didn't turn out the way you hoped. I thought he was taking you out to dinner."
"He bloody didn't turn out to be anything. We went out to dinner. I invited him back to the flat, and he started showing me pictures of his partner, Dennis."
I started to laugh.
"Oh, Scarlett, do you think we're both doomed?
It's too bad we don't fancy each other, isn't it?
Do you think someone could learn to become a lesbian?"
"I don't think so." I was still laughing. "It is good to hear your voice. I've had to be polite to people I don't know all day, and tomorrow I have to have lunch with a very earnest young solicitor."
"There you are, then. Someone your type. No more lawyers, thank you. Actually, no more men, thank you. I've learned my lesson. From now on, I live a quiet life. No men, no sex. Study and books and the occasional lonely meal at a good restaurant. And cats. Don't forget the cats."
I laughed then. "I need to get back to London as soon as possible. If the solicitor tells me I can do what I like with the things in the lodge, I'll have an auctioneer come and pick up anything worth selling. Then the rest goes to a charity shop. And goodbye, Langley Hall." When I put the phone down, I realized what an effort it was to sound bright and cheerful. "Keep busy," I told myself. That's what I had to do. So I got a large rubbish bag and started filling it with my father's clothes. I wasn't sure if anyone would want handkerchiefs with a monogram on them, but you never know. Then I filled a box with books, setting aside a few that had been my childhood favorites, the ones that my father had read to me. By the end of the day, I had cleaned out the bedroom and the linen closet. Then I went through my father's desk, carefully this time, in case there was a will or some other surprise hidden in a secret drawer. There was a post office savings book with £500 in it, a receipt for some shares in a building society, a bank book. That was about it. It seemed my father was probably worth a little over £1,000. Better than nothing. I opened a tin of soup for my supper. As I stood stirring it at the stove, I was suddenly overcome by a memory of my mother standing at the same stove and stirring a big pot. "Chicken stew and dumplings," she said, beaming at me. "Your father's favourite. This will cheer him up if anything will." The memory of that warm, friendly kitchen with its good smells and kind words was too much for me. I turned the stove off, left the soup, and went to bed. Chapter 8. Joanna. April 1973. The next day, I was about to leave to catch the train to Godalming when there was a tap at the door. Two burly men stood there carrying a trunk between them.
"Where do you want it, miss?"
one of them asked. Seeing my surprise, the other added,
"It's from the attic. Miss Honeywell told us to bring down your things."
"Oh, I see. Thank you. This way, please," I stammered. I led them through to the sitting room.
"There's some pictures, too. We'll be back,"
the one who spoke first said. "I have to leave now to catch a train," I said. "Just put them in the sitting room with the trunk, would you?" And I left. Barton and Holcroft's offices were in an elegant Georgian building at one end of Godalming High Street. Nigel Barton appeared from an inner office before I could announce myself.
"We'll be back in an hour, Sandra,"
he said to the receptionist. He ushered me out of the door, down the street, and into the Boar's Head. It was one of those quaint old pubs with leaded panes in the windows, and a quiet hum of conversation from the few people standing around the bar. Good smells came from the kitchen. Nigel found us a high-backed oak booth and went to order our drinks. He came back to report that there was roast lamb or fish pie. Normally I would have selected something lighter at lunchtime, but I found I was starving and willingly accepted the roast lamb. As he had predicted, it was excellent. I suddenly realized how long it had been since I had had good food. Not really since my mother had died, and how much I enjoyed it. When our plates were clean, Nigel stacked them to one side.
"Now to business," he said. "I take it you found no will."
I shook my head. "There is a savings book, a receipt from a building society for some shares, and his bank book, but probably not over £1,000 in total." He nodded.
"You'll need the death certificate before they'll hand over any of that money, and I'll have to write a solicitor's letter. Apart from that, there are no assets?"
"A couple of good pieces of furniture that I might put up for auction. I think I'd like to keep the desk, but I'm not sure where I'd put it."
"I'll have to locate your brother before you do anything," he said.
I didn't think I'd heard right. "My brother? I'm an only child."
"Your half-brother. From your father's first marriage."
He took in my shocked face.
"You didn't know your father had been married before?"
"No, I was never told. I knew that my parents had both married late in life and that I was a complete surprise to them, but I had no idea." I let the rest of the sentence drift away as I tried to come to terms with this news. "When was this?"
"Your father was married before the war and had a son. The marriage was dissolved when he returned at the end of the war. His wife married again and took the child to live in America. Lord knows how I'll trace him now. I believe the stepfather adopted him, but I presume he'd still inherit the title, if he wanted to do such a thing in America."
I was still in shock. How could my father have lived with me all those years and never even mentioned his son? And more to the point, why had his son never been in contact with him since the end of the war?
I'll get in touch with the American Embassy, Nigel said. But I wouldn't worry. I think it's quite clear that your father would have wanted you to inherit what little he left.
And if it wasn't quite clear? I was thinking. If the law decided that an oldest son should inherit everything? £1,000 would make all the difference to me now, especially at this uncertain time. If my law firm wouldn't take me back, then I could still survive with that money.
If his stepfather legally adopted him, then presumably he'd have no claim, I said. He's no longer a Langley.
Complicated matter, if American law is involved, he said. Still, more interesting than most of the cases I'm given. Is your practice more exciting than that of a high street solicitor?
Not at all, I said. I expect it's pretty much the same. Lots of conveyancing.
You chose to be a solicitor and not a barrister?
He asked.
You wanted the comfortable, quiet life rather than the excitement?
I looked down at the worn oak table. Actually, I'd have very much liked to be a barrister, I said. I got a good degree, but I had more than one thing against me. Money, for starters. The chambers at which I interviewed were quite keen on me when they heard I was the daughter of Sir Hugo Langley and thought it meant I was part of the country set with good connections. They lost interest when they found out they were wrong and we were penniless. And then there's the fact that I'm a woman. The elderly head of chambers told me outright that I was wasting my time. If I became a barrister, I'd get none of the juicy cases. No solicitor worth his salt would want to put his case in the hands of a woman, when almost all judges are male and most juries are male, and none of them would take a woman seriously.
That's preposterous, Nigel said.
But true? He nodded.
I suppose it is true. Still, there are plenty of interesting things to do once you qualify. Corporate law, international law, as well as criminal.
Yes. I gave him a bright smile. I haven't quite decided what I'd like to do yet. Pass that wretched exam first, right?
I'm sure you'll ace it.
His smile seemed a little too friendly for comfort. So what's next? I asked. For my father's estate, I mean.
I'll see to the death certificate, try to contact your brother, and, if you like, I could send an appraiser to see if anything you have is worth sending to an auction.
You're very kind.
No, my grandfather would kill me if I didn't take proper care of a Langley.
He grinned, making him look absurdly young again. A nice, pleasant, harmless young man. And yet Adrian had been all of those things. One should learn from one's mistakes. Nigel escorted me to the station, and I took a taxi back to Langley Hall. I almost fell over the two trunks and large brown paper-wrapped parcel deposited right inside the sitting room. I had to admit to being rather curious. I suppose at the back of my mind was always the thought that the lost Langley jewels might be in one of them. I tore off the brown paper wrapping from the large parcel and found myself looking at my own face. It was so startling that I almost dropped the picture. It was even more startling when I read the inscription. Joanna Langley, 1749 to 1823. My heart was racing so fast that I had to sit down. I examined the portrait again and noticed subtle differences. She had hazel eyes, and mine were blue. She also had a mole of some sort on her left cheek, and a slightly longer nose. I was looking at an ancestor, but it felt rather special to know I had a namesake who looked like me. It affirmed for the first time that I really was a Langley, and that the lovely house down the drive was my birthright. The rest of the pictures were all portraits of various Langley ancestors. Most of them were dark and gloomy, and I wasn't sure I would want to keep many of them. I suppose I should, given they were my only ties to my past. Some day I'd have a place of my own, when I was a rich corporate lawyer, a flat overlooking the Thames, all glass and modern furniture, and I'd put these pictures on the wall just to impress my clients. But they'd need cleaning first. They were awfully dirty from generations of candle smoke and neglect. I felt quite cheerful when I opened the first of the trunks to find it contained more pictures, only this time bright, modern ones. I was looking at splashes of Italian sunshine, old stone buildings, black cypresses. I read the signature in the corner of one. Hugo Langley. So my father really had been a painter. What's more, he had been talented.
What on earth made him give it up? I put the pictures aside, intending to show them to Nigel. Maybe they would fetch serious money at an auction, if I could bear to part with them. Then I opened the second trunk. This one held old albums with leather covers and impressive clasps. Photos of long-ago Langleys in long dresses and ridiculous hats, frozen in time as they posed for a camera, or standing in groups outside Langley Hall holding tennis rackets or having tea on the lawn. I was witnessing the lifestyle I'd never know. I put the books aside and delved deeper. A silver cup presented to Sir Robert Langley as Master of Hounds. A smaller one to Hugo for winning the high jump during sports day at Eton. Then I came to a small leather box, beautifully tooled and gold embossed. I opened it, anticipating those long-lost jewels, and almost closed it again when I saw that it contained only a tiny carved wooden angel, what looked like a medal of some sort on a ribbon, a cigarette packet, a bird's feather, and a folded-up envelope. Why anybody would keep such trifles in such a lovely box, I couldn't imagine. Some Langley from history playing a game of pretend as I had done as a child, maybe. I took out the cigarette packet to throw it away, when I saw that it had been opened. On the inside of the cardboard was a sketch of a beautiful woman. It was only a tiny sketch, hastily done and not in any way finished, but somehow it conveyed the woman's personality. I could see her eyes almost sparkling with amusement as she looked at her sketcher, her mouth about to smile. I smoothed it out and put it down on the table. Then I unfolded the envelope. I recognized my father's elegant handwriting. It had an airmail stamp on it, and it was addressed to a Signora Sofia Bartoli in a place called San Salvatore in Tuscany. The date beside the stamp was April 1945, but it had never been opened. Another stamp beside the address was in Italian, but I got the gist of it. Not known at this address. Returned to sender. Intrigued now, I tore the envelope carefully open. To my annoyance, the letter was in Italian. I managed to read, "Mia carissima Sofia." I stared in disbelief. I couldn't imagine my cold and distant father calling anyone his beloved. He certainly never showed any such outpouring of affection to my mother or me. I tried to read on, but the rest was beyond me. Then I remembered an Italian dictionary among the books I had put in a box to take to the charity shop. I ran to retrieve it, then sat at the kitchen table, frowning in concentration as I tried to make sense of the words. It was lucky I'd had years of Latin and French schooling, because that made it easier. And when I had finished, I could not quite believe what I had translated. Surely I must have got it wrong. I went through it again. "My darling Sophia, how I miss you every day. How long the months have seemed since I was with you. All that time in hospital, not knowing if you were safe, wanting to write to you but not daring to do so. But I have good news. If your husband is indeed dead, then we are free to marry. When I was finally allowed to return home to England, I learned that my wife had found someone else and left me for a better life in America. As soon as this horrible war is over, and the news indicates this will be very soon, I will come for you, my love. In the meantime, I want you to know that our beautiful boy is safe. He is hidden where only you can find him." I broke off in amazement. My father, my distant, unemotional father, had a child in Italy. A child with an Italian woman called Sophia. But hidden where only Sophia could find him. A chill came over me. The letter was never delivered. A child hidden away and never found. Of course now, 28 years later, I had to hope that Sophia had recovered the child and all was well. Chapter 9. Joanna. April 1973. I don't know how long I sat there staring at the flimsy sheet of airmail paper. Having grown up as an only child, I was shocked to discover in one day that I might have two brothers in other parts of the world. If this one had survived, I thought. Perhaps he had been hidden with a kind family in the hills, to be reunited with his mother when hostilities ceased. That is what I tried to believe. But now I was dying to know more. My father never spoke of his wartime experiences, but I knew from my mother that he had been a pilot with the RAF, and terribly brave, flying missions over occupied Europe until he was shot down and nearly died. I hadn't even known this happened over Italy. One didn't tend to think of Italy as a scene of bombing missions. I turned away in frustration. If only I had known about this before he had died, I could have asked him. I could have found out the truth. Now I'd have to fish it out for myself. I finished going through the two trunks and didn't find anything of value to anyone but a Langley. Not a single picture of the first wife or my half-brother. But there were some small snapshots of a younger, healthier version of my father, laughing with friends at a cafe. Written on the back of one was Florence, 1935. I put the trunks to one side and went back to emptying linen closets, the pantry, the bathroom cupboard, assembling a big pile to be donated and an equally big pile to be taken out with the rubbish. I found that I felt completely unsentimental about discarding items from my childhood, only anxious to get this task done and set off on my quest. The next day, I was hauling out bags and boxes for the dustman when a car drew up and Nigel got out, accompanied by an older man.
"This is Mr. Aston Smith," Nigel said. "He's an appraiser. I thought we'd get a jump on things and have the furniture valued."
I escorted them inside, apologizing for the mess. I showed him the family portraits, a few good pieces of furniture. I was tempted to show Nigel the letter. I needed to show it to somebody, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. Mr. Aston Smith didn't take long. He walked around making muttering noises and scribbling in a notebook. In a very short time, he came back to me.
"Not much here, I'm afraid," he said. "The desk is a fine piece. You'd probably be looking at a good £500 at auction. The chest upstairs may be slightly less. The grandfather clock, that might also bring in serious money. The armoire, well, it's good wood, but nobody wants large pieces of furniture like that these days."
"And the pictures?"
"On the wall. Prints, worth maybe £100 apiece.
"I meant the other pictures, my father's work."
"They are good, I'll grant you that," he said. "He doesn't have a name, does he? It all depends on name for modern art at the big auctions. Snob value rather than quality, I'm afraid. Again, they'd bring in an amount in the hundreds rather than the thousands."
"And the family portraits?"
"I can't tell you much. They are all in need of a good cleaning, as I'm sure you noticed. If you like, I can take them to an art restorer I work with, and we can make a judgment on them after they've been cleaned."
"Would that be very expensive?" I was conscious that the amount I was to inherit was hardly a fortune, especially if I had to share it with a newly discovered brother.
"Not too horrendously so, depending on the amount of restorative work that would need to be done. Just a simple cleaning to begin with, and then we could make a decision about whether to proceed."
I glanced at Nigel. He gave me one of his hopeful smiles. "All right, then," I said. "Please do take them." As they headed for the front door, I made a decision. "And I want to keep the desk," I said, "but I've nowhere to put it at the moment."
"Maybe they'll let you store it in the school attic," Nigel suggested, "with any other small bits and pieces you are hanging on to."
"Excellent idea," I smiled at him. "Miss Honeywell should be amenable since I'm rushing to get the place cleared out. I'll ask her."
"How long do you think you'll still be here?"
Nigel asked. "I hope to be gone by the end of the week." I saw his face fall.
"I see. Presumably you need to get back to work."
Of course I needed to get back to work, but I wasn't sure I still had a job. Nevertheless, I smiled and nodded.
"I'll keep you up to date," he said, "and I'll let you know when the funds from the various accounts will pass to you."
I looked at Mr. Aston Smith. "Perhaps your person should hold off with the restoring work on the paintings until I know that I have legally inherited the money."
"Very well," he said. "I'll take them with me, but await your instructions. And presumably I should do the same with the furniture you want to send to auction. We don't want to sell anything you don't have a right to."
Don't worry, Nigel said. I'll take care of it. You go back to London. I'll telephone you with any news.
And so they left with my family portraits. I went on with my clearing up. Later, I was about to sit down with a cup of tea when there was another knock at my front door. This time, a large, florid man stood there. He frowned when he saw me.
So, what's this with the girls' school?
He asked in a deep voice with a definite transatlantic accent.
When did Langley Hall get sold?
Right after the war, I said.
Too bad. I was hoping to look around the old place. Are you the gatekeeper's daughter?
I'm Joanna Langley, I said stiffly. Daughter of Sir Hugo Langley. His eyebrows shot up.
No kidding. So the old man married again? What do you know?
It was just dawning on me who this was. I stared at his face and saw no resemblance to my father, who had always had the lean appearance of a romantic poet. This man was well-fed and chubby in a not particularly attractive way. You're Hugo's son? I asked.
That's right. Teddy Langley, I used to be. Now I'm Teddy Schultz, of Cleveland, Ohio.
I forced myself to hold out my hand. I'm pleased to meet you, Teddy. Until a couple of days ago, I had no idea that I had a brother. It came as a big shock.
Yeah, I just got a shock, too. The old guy's death, I mean. A client came back from England and showed me the newspaper with the obituary in it. Any relation of yours? He said. So I thought I'd better hightail it over the pond, being the son and heir, you know. I presumed the estate would be coming to me. Isn't that how it works with the English law? Oldest son gets the lot?
I didn't know what to say to this. In truth, I was feeling a little like Alice plunging down a rabbit hole that revealed one unpleasant surprise after another. Teddy had been looking around as he spoke.
So who got the dough from the sale of the house?
The dough? I stared at him. The money from the sale all went to pay off the death duties when my grandfather died and my father inherited. We've been living in the lodge ever since, and my father was the art master at the school.
No money? That's too bad. I always pictured my pa living in luxury in the big house of my childhood.
He glanced at the lodge.
Certainly not like this. So what about the furniture and stuff? All those creepy antiques I remember. I presume I'm entitled to a half share, as his son.
I had taken an instant dislike to him. You inherit the title, so I'm told, but I expect you'd have to revert to being Teddy Langley.
Sir Teddy. Well, ain't that a kick? Does it come with an allowance?
It comes with nothing. I forced myself to be gracious and British. I've been clearing out my father's belongings, and you are welcome to look through old photograph albums and see if there are any photos you want, or any pieces of furniture, for that matter.
Sure. Okay.
A gleam had come into his eyes. I led him inside. He looked at the sad piles of stuff waiting for the van from the charity shop.
Is this it?
He asked.
This is how you lived?
This is it.
And no money?
Again, I had to wrestle with myself, to be honest. I think he might have had up to £1,000 in his various saving accounts. He gave me an incredulous stare.
£1,000? That's all? You'd better keep it. I've done pretty well for myself. My old man, Schultz, went into the real estate business after the war, and I joined him right after college. Strip malls, mainly. I make more than that in a week. You clearly need it more than I do.
Thank you, I said. Actually, I do need it. I don't have anywhere to live right now.
You're not married?
I'm only 25, I said. I've plenty of time for that when I qualify.
As what?
A solicitor. I'm taking my exams this year.
An attorney, huh? They make good money.
When and if I qualify, I said. Look, would you like a cup of tea? I've just made a pot.
Sure, why not?
He said.
A cup of tea. That's what everyone drank all through the war. A bomb was dropped and everyone said, it's all right, have a cup of tea.
And he laughed. I served him tea and some slightly stale biscuits. I don't think he enjoyed either. I'll give you the name of the solicitor who is handling Father's estate, I said. He was going to ask the American Embassy to help find you. Now you've saved him that task. But he can tell you the particulars about the title.